Hey everyone, it's Jeanette
and Kim,
producers here at the Bitchery of History. As we close out season three, we want to hear from you, our listeners, and give you something in return. So, from now until the end of May, everyone who leaves us a review will be qualified for a giveaway.
What? Amazing. So you might have seen on our Insta or on the website store that we have brand new Bitches Get Stuff Done stickers, which are amazing. So if you send us a screenshot of your review, we'll send you a sticker in return for free.
For free.
What?
You can DM us your screenshot on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, or you can email us directly at umpboh@gmail.com.
And this giveaway only lasts until May 31st, so hurry and tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, be our friend, get a sticker, and remember,
bitches get stuff done.
Hi, friends.
Hello.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Allison.
And I'm Max.
This week, I'm going to be talking to you about Pauli Murray. Get ready to weep.
And I'm talking about Fannie Lou Hamer. So while I'm crying, you're going to cry, and everyone's just going to be in tears.
So much crying. It's going to be great. And after that speech that we heard on last week's episode, which if you haven't heard, go check it out. I cannot wait to hear more about her life. So take it away.
All right. So Fannie Lou Hamer is just about as grassroots activist-y as you can get.
Praise.
Now, she's born Fannie Lou Townsend on October 6, 1917, in Montgomery County, Mississippi. Fannie was the last of 20 children of Ella and James Lee Townsend. 20 children. Now,
I can't imagine. As a woman, I can't even imagine. Okay?
Okay.
Also as a man, but like, I'm not a man, but you feel me.
It's just, that's a number that it's...
That's going to be a zero for
me. They could have a show on TLC.
Jeez.
Now, right when Fannie's born, the family livestock was mysteriously poisoned, and the family, they suspected a local white supremacist, which probably
is reasonable.
Yeah. So after this 1919, which is 2 years after she's born, or about a year and a half after she's born, they moved to work as sharecroppers on W.D. Marlowe's plantation.
Okay.
Now, Fannie began working in the fields at age six. Attended plantation's one-room school, provided for sharecroppers' children. She loved to read and excelled in the spelling bee and wrote poetry.
However,
at the age of 12, she had to go back into the fields to
help her parents.
Of course. Now, at some point in her childhood, Fannie actually gets polio, which leaves her left leg disfigured. But despite that, she goes back into the field and continues working. Now, in 1944, when the plantation owner discovers that she's literate, he selects her to be the time and record keeper of the plantation. Now, this is 1944. She's born 1917. So there's a large period of her early life that we're just...
We don't really know that much about.
Mm-hmm. So she becomes the time and record keeper for the plantation, and it's that same year when she marries her husband, Perry or Pap Hamer, who was a tractor farmer on that same plantation. And they remained there for the next 18 years. Now, they adopted two girls, as all of Hamer's own pregnancies had failed. And one of the girls got run over by a car.
Oh, man.
Now, this is a little bit later that she's hit by the car. And Fannie had actually been well known for her activism at the time. And local hospitals actually denied her daughter admission to get treatment because of Fannie's activism.
What?
Her daughter died because of her activism.
Oh, my God.
Right. So,
problems.
Right. Exactly. Now, 1961, while having surgery to remove a tumor, this is another side note, Fannie was given a hysterectomy without her consent by a white doctor. Jeanette wrote, what the fuck?
Yeah, that's not really the point.
Apparently, the procedure was part of Mississippi's compulsory sterilization plan, which was put in place to reduce the number of poor blacks in the state.
Yep.
Fannie said in 1964, quote, in the North Sunflower Country Hospital, I would say about 6 out of 10 Negro women that go into the hospital are sterilized by having their tubes tied.
Oy.
Now, 1962 is when she attends a protest meeting led by the Student Nonviolent Coordination Committee, mm-hmm. also known as SNCC. And it's here where she meets civil rights activists who are encouraging African Americans to register to vote. So she became active in voter registration efforts. On August 31st of that year, Fannie travels to Indianola, Mississippi to try and register to vote with the other activists by taking the state's literacy test, which was, of course, targeted at preventing Black people from voting. She didn't pass. And when she returned to the plantation, Marlo fires her for attempting to register, which we heard in that right. speech last time. Apparently, he asked her to withdraw her registration application. And she said to him, as in the speech, "I didn't go down there to register for you. I went down there to register for myself." After getting fired from the plantation, she actually has to move between homes for the next several days for her protection because people were out to get her for her activism and for trying to vote. On September 10th of that year, she was shot at 16 times in a drive-by shooting by white supremacists, but she wasn't hit. And she also references that in the speech mm-hmm. as well. After this incident, Fannie and her family evacuated in fear of the KKK, of the mm-hmm. Ku Klux Klan. And they were there for 3 months before returning back to their home in December. As soon as she returned, Fannie went back to the courthouse in Indianola to take the literacy test, failing again. And she told the registrar, quote, "You'll see me every 30 days until I pass."
God bless.
She also said,
"I'm sure she passed."
She did eventually. Yes.
No, but I mean, like, I'm sure she was passing.
Right.
Probably.
And they were just like, "What's the color of the sky on the 5th of November?"
Yeah.
Like, impossible questions.
Yeah.
She also said at the time, "I guess if I'd had any sense, I'd have been a little scared. But what was the point of being scared? The only thing they could do was kill me. And it kind of seemed like they'd been trying to do that a little bit at a time since I could remember."
Oh, these two women, all the chills. Okay, keep going.
On January 10th, 1963, Fannie takes the literacy test for the third time, and she passes.
Praise.
She's now registered to vote in the state of Mississippi. However, when she went to vote that fall, the registration was not enough for her to vote. She also needed to have paid 2 poll taxes.
What?
Side note about this. All these poll taxes and the literacy tests and everything are kind of a little bit of Elizabeth Cady Stanton's fault.
Oh, no.
So all of the racially charged speeches she gave against the ratification of the 15th Amendment is one of the reasons why these were put into place. So while Elizabeth thought that she was fighting to get the rights to vote for everybody by saying that this doesn't go far enough, it was used to further disenfranchise people of color from voting.
Boo.
Right. So during this time, Fannie becomes more involved in SNCC. She goes and attends many Southern Christian leadership conferences, taking classes and workshops. She travels the South, getting signatures for petitions, calling for federal resources for impoverished Black families in the South. She became a field secretary for voter registration and welfare programs for SNCC. And she also tried to help other African-American people to vote, mm-hmm. but they were met with the same continued resistance that she had faced. Now, 1963, I'm not going to talk too much about the events of the bus ride to Charleston because she talks about it in the speech. And it's almost exact. I mean, she talks exactly about what happens.
So listen to that episode.
So listen to that episode and listen to that speech. Or you can just Google Fannie Lou Hamer 1964 DNC speech. What I should note, though, that she doesn't mention in the speech is that after being beaten in that jail cell, she never fully recovers. It takes her more than a month to get back to sort of normal. Mm. But it leaves her with a blood clot in her left eye, just over her left eye, and permanent damage to both of her kidneys.
Oh, my God.
Now, despite this, Fannie returns home to Mississippi, continues to organize voter registration drives, including a mock election that year. 1964 rolls around the next year. She co-founds a group called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which is what she references in that speech.
Okay.
Which was an attempt to prevent the region's all-white Democratic Party's attempt to stifle African-American voices. Now, after they found this group, this is the same year of the Democratic National Convention. They go to the convention. They demand to be seated. They are refused, obviously. And there's a senator, his name is Hubert Humphrey, who proposes a compromise where they would get 2 seats at the conference, but they would be at large seats and they wouldn't have voting. They wouldn't have the ability to vote. And Fannie turned them down. She said, quote, "We didn't come all the way up here to compromise for no more than we'd gotten here. We didn't come all this for no two seats when all of us is tired." Now, 1968, which is 4 years later, they do actually get seated. And it's then when the Democratic Party adopts a clause which demands equality of representation for their state's delegations.
Nice.
In 1972, at the next one, Fannie Lou Hamer is elected as a National Party delegate.
Of course.
A lot more political stuff happens. Mm-hmm. What I want to focus on for the last little bit here is what she did to help people kind of break free from the systems of oppression. One of the biggest things that she fought for and believed in was giving African Americans equality in agriculture. Because in the South, of course, agriculture was the dominant economic engine.
Yeah.
So sharecropping had become the most common form. And she pioneered something called the Freedom Farm Collective, which was an attempt to redistribute economic power across groups and to try and solidify economic standing for African Americans. So she partners with the NCNW to establish an interregional program called the Pig Project.
Okay.
Which provided protein for people who could not afford to buy it.
Oh, wow.
So started by a donation from the NCNW, which again is the National Council for Negro Women. She was given 5 grown boars and 50 gilts or baby pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And through the through this pig bank, a family could care for a pregnant female pig until it bore its offspring. And then they could raise the piglets, using them for food and financial gain, and then give the pregnant pig back to the
farm. So it's like
the
original heifer project.
Yes, exactly.
That's so cool.
Exactly. So within 5 years, there were thousands of pigs available for breeding.
Amazing.
And Fannie used the success of the pig bank to begin fundraising for various causes. She convinced the editor of the Harvard Crimson to write an article that encouraged people to raise money for the Freedom Farm Collective. And eventually, they raised $8,000, which is the equivalent of $60,000 today.
Amazing.
Which, you know, is difficult. We did that for Fannie.
Yeah. Very hard.
And with it, Fannie purchased 40 acres of land that had previously been owned by a black farmer who could no longer afford it.
Oh my gosh.
And this became the Freedom Farm.
Oh.
The main objectives of the Freedom Farm were to establish agricultural organization that could supplement the nutritional needs of America's most disenfranchised people, provide acceptable housing development, and to create an entrepreneurial business incubator that would provide resources for new companies and retraining for those with limited education. The FFC aided in securing 35 Federal Housing Administration subsidized houses for struggling black families.
Wow.
And so she's doing all this amazing stuff.
Right.
But also around this time is when she starts having health issues.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in 1972, she's hospitalized for nervous exhaustion.
God.
And then again in 1974 for a nervous breakdown.
Oh my gosh.
And by then, she's just really deteriorating health-wise. And she's diagnosed with and has surgery for breast cancer.
Ugh.
March 14th, 1977, at the age of 59, Fannie dies of complications of hypertension and breast cancer.
Mm.
She's buried in Ruleville, Mississippi, and her tombstone is engraved with one of her most famous quotes, "I am sick and tired of being sick and tired."
Love.
My other favorite thing about where she's buried is that she's buried on her own land, and it was a request from her. She said, I was born and spent most of my life on a sharecropping plantation, and I will not be buried on one.
That is awesome.
So some awards and tributes.
Okay.
She received a Doctor of Law from Shaw University.
Nice.
Honorary degrees from Columbia College Chicago in 1970 and Howard University in 1972. Inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame in 1993. A remembrance of her life was given in the U.S. House of Representatives on the 100th anniversary of her birth, which was October 6, 2017, by Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee.
Nice.
1976, the city of Ruleville celebrated a Fannie Lou Hamer Day. 1977, Gil Scott Heron and Brian Jackson wrote the song 95 South, All the Places We've Been, in her honor. In 1994, the Rouville Post Office was named the Fannie Lou Hamer Post Office by an act of Congress.
Whoa.
A picture book of Fannie's life was written by Carol Boston Weatherford, won a Coretta Scott King Award. She is one of the 28 civil rights icons depicted on the Buffalo, New York Freedom Wall. And a quote from Hamer's speech at the 1964 Democratic National Convention is carved on one of the 11 granite columns at the Civil Rights Garden in Atlantic City, where the convention was held.
Amazing.
So that's Fannie Lou Hamer.
I love it.
What I love about her story, more than all of her achievements, which are many and mm-hmm. amazing, is that she was just a normal person. Like, she didn't, yeah. she wasn't bred for politics. She didn't like grow up knowing a politician or anyone. She went to one political action meeting. She said,
and was like, this.
This is exactly what this. I should be doing. And then exploded into yeah. being like this.
Literally,
amazing
I volunteer as tribute. literally
said, oh, I can do this.
Yeah. I believe that Fannie would have enjoyed this quote from Polly Murray. Quote, if anyone should ask a Negro woman in America what has been her greatest achievement, her honest answer would be, I survived.
I think that's... Did Fannie say that?
No, that was Polly Murray in 1970.
Channeling.
So she was born Anna Pauline Murray in Baltimore, Maryland, November 20th of 1910. She came from a background of actually mixed racial origins, and the varied features of her family were described as United Nations in miniature.
Oh, I love that.
Her parents, William Murray, was a school teacher and Agnes Murray was a nurse. They both identified as Black. Now, in 1914, Polly's mother, Agnes, died, and shortly after, William was committed to a psychiatric institution due to typhoid fever. So relatives took custody of Polly and her siblings. She was sent to live with her mother's family in Durham, North Carolina.
Oh, my word. Hey. Shout out, Bull City.
Yep. So she was raised by her aunt, Sarah, and Pauline, who are both teachers, and her grandparents, Robert and Cornelia. She hoped to be able to rescue her father from the mental institution that he was in when she came of age. But when she was 13, her father was beat to death by a white guard.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So she traveled to Baltimore alone to attend his funeral.
Oh, my God.
She stayed in Durham until she was 16 and then moved to New York to finish high school. And there she stayed with her cousin Maud and her family, who are light skin and passed for white. Mm. Polly's darker complexion made Maud's neighbors uncomfortable, but that didn't stop her from graduating high school with honors and enrolling in Hunter College in 1927.
Good for her.
She was the only African-American student among 4,000 students.
Jesus.
In 1930, she married Billy Wynn in secret, but almost immediately regretted the decision because she had no interest in having sex with him.
Oh.
She wondered, quote, why is it when men try to make love to me, something in me fights, end quote. So we're going to circle back to that.
Sure.
Now, both Polly and Billy left town a few months later and didn't speak or see each other again until Polly asked to have the marriage annulled in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
Logical.
Right.
Now, Polly really wanted to attend Columbia College, but they didn't admit women in the 20s, and she couldn't afford to go to the sister school, Bernard College. So instead, she went to Hunter College, which was a free city university. And there she was encouraged to write by a teacher based off an essay she wrote about her grandmother. So she graduates in 1933 with a BA in English. The unemployment rate in Harlem when she graduated was 50%.
Whoa.
Now, while in college, casually, Polly befriends Langston Hughes and met W.E.B. Du Bois just because...
Casual
friends. By the time she was 18, she was living on her own in New York City. So immediately after college, Polly took a job selling subscriptions to the academic journal Opportunity. It was published by the National Urban League, which was a civil rights organization in New York, but she soon fell ill, and her doctor encouraged her to live and work in a healthier environment. So Polly began working at Camp Terra, which was a conservation camp that had been established by Eleanor Roosevelt. They were kind of the female counterpart to the Civilian Conservation Corps that FDR had established.
Okay.
So while she was working there, her health improved, and she met Eleanor Roosevelt, and the two struck up a correspondence that is described just as changing Polly's life.
Just a casual,
just like casual friendships.
Everywhere she goes.
Polly was only at the camp for 3 months. Because of the clashes with the director who found her, one, reading a Marxist book, and also discovered that she had a relationship with a counselor, Peg Holmes. He was more upset that their relationship was interracial than he was about it being same sex. Just as a side note.
Priorities.
I guess. So they both left the camp. They traveled around the country just hitchhiking and walking. In 1938, Polly applied to UNC, but was rejected because of her race. So, boo. Tar Heels. go Wolfpack forever. They probably wouldn't have accepted her either.
Go Spartans.
They probably wouldn't have. Well, they might have.
The Spartans might have.
Originally, the UNC Greensboro where Max and I went to school was an all-female college. So.
A state normal industrial college for women.
I love how it's normal. So when she was rejected, she wrote to all officials ranging from the university president to President Roosevelt about her rejection and then published the responses in the media in hopes to embarrass them into action. The NAACP was initially interested in her case, but then refused to represent her in court. Now, there's a couple of speculations about why, but one is being that Polly dressed more masculine and was very open about her relationships with women. So in 1940, Polly was arrested while walking the streets in Rhode Island. This is not a euphemism. She was literally just walking, not prostituting. Oh, just walking.
She's just walking down the
street. Just walking. And she was taken to Bellevue Hospital in New York City for psychiatric treatment.
Was she doing a funny walk, like a ministry of funny walks?
Well, she might have been dressing like a man.
Oh, she might have had an ice cream cone in her back pocket.
Who knows? Apparently, Polly was having like a breakdown at the time she was arrested due to a breakup. She was able to leave in March with her roommate and now girlfriend, Adeline. So like, just the biggest F you to like, oh, you're going to put me in a psychiatric institution? I'm going to get a girlfriend. It's fine. Now, in Petersburg, Virginia, the couple, Adeline and Polly, sat in the white section of a bus because all the seats in the back part of the bus were broken. This is 1940, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Just right around. So yeah. we're 20 years away from civil rights. When they were asked to move, they refused and they were arrested and jailed. And they were initially defended by the NAACP. But when mix that one up. But when they were just charged with disorderly conduct rather than violating segregation laws, the organization dropped them. Workers' Defense League stepped up and paid their fines and then hired Polly to work for its administrative committee. So through the Workers' Defense League, Polly became active in the case of Odell Waller, a black sharecropper in Virginia who was sentenced to death for killing his white landlord. The WDL argued that it was self-defense, and Polly toured around the country raising money for his appeal and wrote to First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt on his behalf. Eleanor responds and wrote to the Virginia governor asking for a guaranteed fair trial and persuaded FDR to privately request the governor to commute the death sentence. Unfortunately, this did not work.
Oh, no.
And Waller was executed in July of 1942. However,
it's amazing she got a response from Eleanor, though.
Yeah, this is what sparked a lasting correspondence and friendship between them that continued until Eleanor's death.
Oh, wow.
Polly's experiences with being arrested and with working for Waller's case inspired her to pursue a career in civil rights law. So in 1941, she attends Howard Law School. She was the only woman in her classes, in her law classes, and labeled the sexism she faced there as Jane Crow. On her first day of class, her professor said he did not understand why women went to law school. Despite this, Polly was elected Chief Justice of the Howard Court of Peers, the highest student position at Howard, and graduated first in her class.
Of course she did.
I mean, duh.
Because bitches get stuff done.
For real. So men who came in at the top of their class at Howard were awarded the Julius Rosenwald Fellowship for graduate work at Harvard University, but that university did not accept women, and Polly was rejected, despite the fact that President Roosevelt wrote her a letter of support. She wrote in response to her rejection, quote, "I would gladly change my sex to meet your requirements, but since the way to such change has not been revealed to me, I have no response but to appeal to you to change your minds. Are you to tell me that one is as difficult as the other?" End quote. Mic drop.
Are you to tell me that one is as difficult as the other?
So she did her postgraduate work at the Bolt Hall School of Law at UC Berkeley. Her thesis for her master's was entitled "The Right to Equal Opportunity in Employment," arguing that work is an inalienable right.
There you go.
Whew. She passed the California bar exam and was hired as California's first black deputy attorney general the following year. In 1945, Polly was named Woman of the Year by the National Council of Negro Women, and Mademoiselle magazine named her the same in 1947. In 1950, she published State's Laws on Race and Color, which was an examination and critique of state segregation laws. She was asked by the Methodist Church to write this because the Methodist Church was against segregation but was trying to figure out, like, can we be against it in all the states where we have churches? Or like, what's up?
Oh, okay.
Now, the arguments that Polly made were influential to the NAACP's arguments in Brown versus Board of Education. Here is a great lady bit.
Okay.
To go even deeper, while a student at Howard University, Pauli was arguing with one of her professors that Plessy versus Ferguson would be overturned in 25 years, and they bet on it. He never forgot about her, and when this professor joined Thurgood Marshall and others to try to end Jim Crow, he remembered Murray's paper, fished it out of his files, and presented it to his colleagues, the team that in 1954 successfully argued Brown versus Board of Education. She didn't know about this influence of her contribution until she was 50. Then at one point, this is all in bold, she co-wrote a law review article that was used by Ruth Bader Ginsburg to convince the Supreme Court that the Equal Protection Clause applies to women. The two also briefly worked at the same firm.
Oh my God. So she helped overturn segregation in schools.
Yes.
And help.
Yes.
Expand the 15th Amendment.
I'm not
to cover everyone.
Even close to done.
Keep going. Keep going, please.
Then she lives in Ghana from 1960 to 1961 and served on the faculty of the Ghana School of Law. When she returned to the U.S., she studied at Yale Law School and in 1965 became the first African-American, male or female, to receive a Doctor of the Science of Law degree from the school.
Whoa.
In 1961, President JFK appointed Murray to the Presidential Commission of the Status of Women. She wrote a memo that argued that the 14th Amendment should be interpreted to forbid sex discrimination as well as racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. In 1963, she became the first person to criticize the sexism of the civil rights movement in a speech she gave called The Negro Woman and the Quest for Equality. She criticized the fact that no woman was invited to give a major speech during the March on Washington. She said, quote, "I have been increasingly perturbed over the blatant disparity between the major role which Negro women have played and are playing in the crucial grassroots level of our struggle and the minor role of leadership they've been assigned in the national policymaking decisions. It is indefensible to call a national march on Washington and send out a call which contains the name of not a single woman leader."
Wow. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. She spits fire like no one's business.
So she gives a speech in 1964 in Washington titled Jim Crow and Jane Crow.
That's the same year that Fannie did her speech.
She said of African-American women, quote, "Not only have they stood with Negro men in every phase of the battle, but they have also continued to stand when their men were destroyed by it. One cannot help asking, would the Negro struggle have come this far without the indomitable determination of its women?"
Probably not.
Nope. Now, in 1973, Pauli left her position teaching law to attend the seminary at an Episcopal church. In 1976, she was ordained to the deaconate, and after 3 years of study, she became the first African-American woman ordained as an Episcopal priest among the first generation of Episcopal women priests.
I just got chills.
She was the first woman to celebrate her Eucharist at the Chapel of the Cross in North Carolina. Side note, that church is very close to the one that I went to.
Uh-huh.
It's not the same, but they're in the same city. They're both in Chapel Hill, like close to UNC.
Oh.
So sometimes we do stuff together and sometimes we don't.
Sister church.
Sort of. In 1978, she preached her first sermon in her hometown of Durham, North Carolina. For the next 7 years, she worked in a parish in Washington, D.C., focusing on ministry to the sick. July 1st, 1985, Pauli Murray died of pancreatic cancer in Pennsylvania. Now, Pauli was never out, even though she didn't hide her relationships with women. Mm-hmm. And reading about how she identified as having an inverted sex instinct, it's pretty clear now that she was probably transgender. She started taking hormone treatments in the 1940s to try to correct her personal imbalance, and at one point even requested to have abdominal surgery to see if she had submerged male sex organs.
Oh, interesting.
Which I found really interesting because sometimes I'm like when we were talking about Agnetus a few weeks ago, there's also a lot of papers who are like, you know, Mozart was schizophrenic or this and that, or Beethoven was this. And a lot of other scientists go, well, you can't really know that because you can't talk to the person.
Sure.
Like you're kind of, it's all kind of hearsay. And so part of me was like, but if that seems pretty legit.
And mental issues tend to come with high intelligence.
Right. Exactly. She could often pass as a teenage boy because of her tiny frame. And when she was arrested for not moving on the bus in 1940, she told the officers her name was Oliver. And she referred to herself as, quote, "one of nature's experiments, a girl who should have been a boy." So
It's
pretty legit. Here's some legacies and honors that just make me want to weep. In 2012, the General Convention of the Episcopal Church voted to honor Polly as one of its holy women, holy men, to be commemorated on the anniversary of her death. Bishop Michael Curry said this recognition honors, quote, people whose lives have exemplified what it means to follow in the footsteps of Jesus and make a difference in the world. Mm. In 2015, the National Trust for Historic Preservation named her childhood home in North Carolina a national treasure. In 2016, Yale University announced that Murray had been selected as the namesake of one of the two new residential colleges. The other is named after Benjamin Franklin.
Oh.
So if we want to, if you want to talk about like what level are we playing at, we're playing at a really high level.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And in 2018, Polly was chosen by the National Women's History Project as one of its honorees for Women's History Month.
So cool. What an amazing woman.
Right? She's cray.
Hey friends, if you're enjoying this podcast, do Allison and myself and Jeanette, Kim, Jess, and Sydney a favor and look down at that phone or computer or iPad or tablet or Zune or, I don't know, spiritual plane that you're listening to this on and give us a rating or a review or both. Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find this podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks.
If you've already done a rating or a review, you are a bitch and you get stuff done. The next level is you can go to patreon.com and search Ursula Major or download the Patreon app and search Ursula Major and become a contributor. For just $1 a podcast, $5 a podcast, you get access to our exclusive contributors blog with bloopers, deleted scenes, other lady bits, and special things just for you. Thanks.
All right. So today, to round out the month, we have another segment of The Bitch Next Door. Today, we're going to be talking to Lily Mercer, who is a writer. She was named one of the top 25 writers to watch in 2018 by the ISA Fast Track Fellowship.
Cool.
And she is an amazing person. She's developing a program that she's going to talk about right now.
It's Jeanette, producer here at Bitchery of History, and I am here today with Lily Mercer. Hello, Lily.
Hey, Jeanette. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Peachy.
So for those of you who don't know, Lily is a screenwriter and an actress and a theater director and all things under the sun. But why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up here in L.A.?
So I grew up in Kentucky, and I always knew I wanted to go into theater, acting, movies, whatever, something. I was just addicted to old movies on television. I don't know if you know anything about Kentucky, but it's not exactly the forward-thinking environment that Los Angeles is.
No way.
So yeah, sadly, I was like wanting to be a blind trapeze artist. They're like, I'm not, no, do we want you to be a dentist? You're so good with your hands. Or my father was a lawyer, and they were like, ah, just why don't you go and take over your dad's law practice? And it was like, no. So yeah, that's, I pursued theater arts in college. I ended up going to New York to the Playwrights Horizons Professional School Conservatory, where I studied acting and directing and playwriting. I made my living as an actor for many years, and then I branched out into directing, and then I branched out into teaching, and I've taught at a couple of different universities. I love teaching, but long story short, I ended up really falling in love with writing. So in 2010, I applied to NYU Tisch for my MFA in film and TV writing and couldn't believe that I got accepted. I thought it was like a sign from the universe. And so I just dropped everything, switched up my career and started writing, dove into the program, graduated in 2012, moved out here in 2013. I've been writing ever since. I've done pretty well in the competition circuit. Yeah. I also was lucky to be named by the ISA as the top 25 writers to watch. And last year, I founded a writing group for film and TV female writers called the Bechdel Babes Writing Partners.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that.
I love Bechdel Babes.
But really quick, the ISA, it stands for the
International Screenwriters Association.
Wonderful. Yeah, let's talk about the Bechdel Babes. Cool. How did it start? How has it evolved? How has it changed when you first started it?
Well, did change a little bit when I first started it. I had this idea. I had been a member of a couple of different writer groups, and even though each one had something to recommend it, it wasn't exactly what I was looking for. So I finally decided I wanted to form my own group, and I ran into somebody I had known from another writer's group, and I was like, I want to start a group for women, and she was like, yeah, me too, and I was like, okay, let's do it together. But ultimately, she wanted to do something a little more traditional, like we're going to meet in a theater, we're going to have actors come in, we're going to read the scripts and blah, blah. And I was like, okay, that costs a lot of money, so which I was specifically short of in the moment. So I said, let's just meet in somebody's living room and read scripts and see where that takes us. So that's how we started. And I had the idea, I guess it was in December, that we should do a showcase of our work. So ultimately, the end of March, we did a showcase called The Other Half of the Story, the Bechdel Babes Showcase. And we were very well received. We had 35 industry people come and see it. And everybody did like short scenes from their work. Yeah. And got to meet people. We were so even more excited that many people came, given that it was a raining weekend.
Yeah.
So a lot of people canceled because it rained. I mean, literally, they called me and they were like, I can't come. It's raining.
I will not leave my apartment. There is a drizzle.
I cannot move. But yeah, that was a really great experience. And so we are rebooting again the end of May. I need to take a little bit of a break because I've been doing this solid for a year and I'm exhausted.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm actually going to take a trip to Japan in a couple of weeks.
What?
I know. So, and then come back and reboot the Bechdel Babes. We have a couple of openings. So if people are interested, please get in touch. They can go to the bbwritingpartners.com website and read all about us.
Yeah, definitely. What has been like the most enlightening thing you've found being in a writer's group full of women, or like the most surprising thing?
It's so interesting that when you set the standard, like, for example, when we have people bring in pages, we have a rule that you have to start with a couple of things that you like first. Because in my old teaching days, I was taught that, you know, if you're trying to teach somebody, you tell them what they're doing right first, and then their minds are open and they're able to receive whatever else you're going to tell them. So that's been the biggest learn, you know, the biggest validation, I think, of anything, is that that we do it that way, and that people are just moving forward with their work so quickly.
Yeah.
As a result, because they're hearing the things that people are saying to them.
Yeah.
As opposed to other groups I've been in where people start out going, well, that doesn't work. And what a stupid idea. What is that? And where did you get that idea? It just, you start just shutting down, and or you get defensive. And so it's a much better process.
Yeah.
A way to start getting things done.
Wonderful. How many women do you have in the group right now?
Right now we have 8. We can really only do 12 because I don't want people to have to wait more than a month to get their pages read.
Good idea.
Yeah. I've been involved with groups that had 20 people and you got to read once every 2 months, and it's frustrating for me to wait that long to hear new pages. Yeah. So that was one thing that I wanted to sort of keep a lid on. So we have 12 people is the max, really.
Mm-hmm.
And and everybody brings in 30 pages at least once a month. Somebody can trade off and say, this month I don't have something, but we don't encourage that. We want people to keep writing.
Yeah, it's always good, I feel, when you're writing, to have someone else that's holding you accountable instead of just yourself.
Mm-hmm. It's so helpful.
Especially when you're first starting off and you don't have like managers or agents or producers over your shoulders saying, where are those pages? So when you do it with a group of people, it's like, oh, if I don't have my pages, I'm going to look not good.
You have a deadline. There's a deadline.
Yeah.
And that's really helpful.
Yeah. That's what I felt like in writing school. I was like, when I was majoring in screenwriting, I was like, if I don't turn in my pages, I'm going to look so dumb. And I was one of the only people that consistently turned in pages every single week. Humble brag.
Yeah. When I was in NYU, we had to do generally 15 to 20 pages per day.
Oh my gosh.
So I was up at 6:30 in the morning cranking it out. And the wonderful thing about that is you just get to be really good at stream of consciousness. You just sit down and start typing, and whatever comes out, comes out. And sometimes you surprise yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, we don't often trust ourselves enough when it comes to things like that.
Yeah.
That it's there. We just have to open the door. You know?
Yeah. I actually just saw when I was on Twitter like an hour or two ago, and Kumail Nanjiani, I probably just said his last name wrong, but he wrote The Big Sick.
Yeah.
And he had tweeted something about how one of the most important things he had learned as a writer is that you just have to write it. And he's like, you can fix things in the rewrite.
That's right.
And to like trust yourself that in the rewrite, it will get better. You just have to put it down.
That's right.
So I do think that 10 to 15 pages a day is daunting, but probably helped improve writing a lot.
Totally. And it gave me a lot of things that I needed to rewrite. Yeah. So I still have things I haven't gone back to.
Wow.
That I wrote from those days. Yeah. That's just crazy. There's not enough time in the world. Yeah.
At a different time, we can talk more about that program because now I'm really interested.
Okay, cool.
This is not a screenwriting podcast, so it's probably not the place. I want to know about the Lost Women of American History TV show that you're developing. So let's talk about that.
Every writer has a passion project. Uh-huh. This is definitely my passion project. So I was teaching at Northern Arizona University and ended up forming a small professional theater in Sedona, Arizona. I was living in Sedona at the time. And in between shows, I would do weekend jaunts and just sort of discover the state, because I found out I had never lived in the desert. I loved the desert. I loved Arizona, the landscape of it. Really loved. So one weekend I would go to the Grand Canyon. One weekend I'd go to Bisbee. And one weekend I went to Tombstone. And the weekend I was in Tombstone, I walked right into the middle of the Nellie Cashman Days Festival. And I was like, who the heck is Nellie Cashman? And why does she have a festival? What did she do? So I ended up reading a book about her, and then read another book, and then read another book. And it was just such a fascinating story. Here was this 5-foot-tall, 100-pound Irish immigrant who came to America right during the potato famine. And mm-hmm. if you don't know about the potato famine, it killed millions of people in Ireland. Mm-hmm. Millions of people died of starvation. So she came with her mother and her sister over here, and she ended up getting involved. Her goal was to really make $1 million. She was so poor, and all she wanted to do was make money and support her family. So she found out about gold miners, and she ended up following the gold rush from state to state. And wherever she went, she would open up a business, a restaurant, and a boarding house. It was her way of making money, because the miners needed someplace to stay and they needed someplace to eat. So she was sort of brilliant in that way.
Yeah.
And as a result, she helped to settle the Southwest. One of her big claims to fame was she led, at the age of 60, a mule train through the snowy Kassir Mountains to save some of her gold mining friends who were starving. And even the police, the Rocky Mountains, this was up in Canada at that point, they were saying, you can't go. This is too dangerous. And she was like, the hell with that, I'm going.
Yeah.
And just undaunted, just totally, completely undaunted. She ended up taking care of her sister died. Her mother died. She ended up taking care of her sister's 5 kids. There are great stories about one of her nephews stealing the wagon and going out into the desert and mm-hmm. with one of his friends, and then getting trapped and being circled by the Indians. And she gets on a horse and goes out there and scares everybody off and drags her nephew and his friend back there. She was just freaking fearless.
Wow.
So just an amazing woman. So that I wrote a screen. I was just enamored of her.
Yeah.
I wrote a screenplay about her.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was just before I got into NYU. And then I went to NYU, and my master's thesis was about another woman named Nellie Bly, who was, a lot of people have heard of Nellie Bly. Yeah, I think you guys did a segment on Nellie. And she was an investigative reporter.
Yes,
in those days, they called them stunt girls. Mm-hmm. And so she would pretend to be somebody else and, you know, become a factory girl or a can-can girl. Or one time she pretended to be a politician's wife to get an interview, and she was quite good at that. She ultimately, one of her biggest stunts was pretending to be crazy and getting admitted to Bellevue. Yeah. And she wrote a book about that called 10 Days in a Madhouse, which made her so famous she couldn't be a stunt girl anymore. So then she decided her next big gig would be to test Jules Verne's book Around the World in 80 yeah. Days. So she, with just one bag to her name, a coat and a hat, which became later quite famous, and she took some coins, and she took a watch, and she took some paper and pens and a change of underwear, and she went around the world. She took a ship, she took a train, she took a donkey, a rickshaw. I mean, it was really amazing what yeah. she did. And she did it in 72 days, and I think she was 25 at the time.
And what's crazy is that there are two movies around the world in 80 days,
yes.
and neither of them are about her.
No. One of them actually has her in there, but they don't really talk about yeah. her.
It's is that the one with like Jackie Chan?
I think so, with all the crazy, yes. But there's another interesting part B of that story is that because the World newspaper at the time uh-huh. was called the World, it's not called New York Times, but mm-hmm. New York Times was called the World. There was another newspaper called the Cosmopolitan, not to be confused with the Cosmopolitan magazine.
Yeah.
And when they heard that Nellie was doing this, they decided to send their own reporter, a female reporter named Elizabeth Bisland, around the world in the other direction to see who would win.
Oh my God.
It's such an interesting story.
That is really fascinating.
Really interesting. By the turn of the century, Nellie Bly was the most famous woman in the world. There were horses named after her, amusement parks named mm-hmm. after her, board games named after her. She was the Angelina Jolie of her times. But she died in obscurity. It's such a great story. So at any rate, I keep digressing. when I started looking into all these women, I realized there's a million of them. There's yes. a million stories. Why isn't there a TV show about this?
Where's the movie?
Where is it? And then that's when I had the idea that I think that we need to have like a television show that celebrates these women and tells the true story of these remarkable, fearless women. The way, you know, we've had three movies about JFK. We've had four movies about Benjamin Franklin.
I mean, and every year there's a Churchill movie coming right. out now.
That's right. Can we not just have one about one of these women?
Yeah.
So I had the idea that I wanted to do, and they just started right now, not right now, but a year ago, the TV series Genius.
Yeah.
With Ron Howard and Brian mm-hmm. Grazer. So they're doing a season on a person. Last year they did Albert Einstein. Now they're doing Picasso. And I want to do the same thing for women. I've been wanting to do it since 2010. I want to do a season about these women. The true story of Pocahontas. Nobody talks about the true story of Pocahontas. They think yeah. she saved John Smith and married him and lived happily ever after. That's not what happened.
Raccoons also don't know how to braid hair.
That's right.
Lots of lies in that movie.
So... Yeah, so I probably am talking your ear off about it, but I just think there's so many amazing women that we, yeah. and they're missing from the history books,
100%.
which is shocking to me.
Yeah.
So dang it, it's time. We need to hear about these women, not just because they were miraculous and did wonderful things and they were brave and courageous, not just because they're interesting characters, but because they teach us what we are capable of doing. And that's exactly what I'm interested in doing in the future. Yeah.
You can't be what you can't see.
That's right. Snaps up to that.
I love it. So you probably can't talk too much about negotiations with the TV show or where it's at right now or whatever you want to keep under wraps, you can keep under wraps. But it is, you are developing this show. And I think you told us you had 3 or 4 episodes written.
I do. I have 3 episodes written, 3 pilots. Yeah. Like I have the Pocahontas pilot, uh-huh. the Nellie Cashman pilot, and the Nellie Bly pilot. And I have been talking to various people just this week mm-hmm. about moving forward and trying to get in the doors. It's interesting. It's every single person I talk to about this series goes, I would watch that. I would love to watch that. When is that going to happen? Then you talk to some production people and they're like, you know, nobody wants to see a show about women in history. And I'm like, oh, you just don't know, you know? It's crazy.
Like, did you see Hidden Figures? Exactly. Everyone wants to see the show about women.
That actually, Hidden Figures is a really good example. Although mine's a TV series, but Hidden Figures had a $25 million budget. They made $200 million. Yeah. Everybody wants to see women in history.
Yes.
That's three women of color.
Yeah.
In obscurity that no one's ever heard of. And that movie was so successful. It yeah. just shows you there is an audience. You just, you know, expand the brain.
If we can have a Winston Churchill movie
that's right.
every year.
That's right.
You can have one TV show that's just about women.
And there was, you know, a 6-episode limited series about John Adams. You know, yeah. John Adams is not a miraculous man necessarily. Yeah. He was an interesting character, but yeah. I don't know that it was earth shattering anything that he did.
Yeah.
So I always use the old, you probably heard me say this before just in talking. Every single person, if I walked into a room and said the name Paul Revere, every single person in that room would know who he was and what he did.
Yes.
And seriously, he got on a horse and said, the British are coming. And that's kind of the extent of it.
And a woman actually did the same exact thing.
I did not know that.
Yes. A woman during the Revolutionary War did the same exact thing. Sybil Ludington.
Wow.
She did the same exact thing.
Wow.
And we don't know her name.
We don't know her name.
Yeah.
But see, that's a crime.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
I agree.
Ridiculous.
I agree. I'm so excited to see where that goes.
Me too. Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah. And we'll talk. We'll obviously be in contact and talk about it.
I hope
all the
so.
Time.
Because I've been saying all week, you're my people.
Yep.
You know.
We found each other.
You're my people. Yeah. You get it.
Yeah. So I want to move on.
Okay.
Who are your role models? And who were your role models growing up? Who did you look up to?
Well, this is going to sound so, it's going to sound like a plant, but Hillary Clinton was a role model of mine.
Yeah.
I read her books and she came from a small town and it wasn't a rich community. And this was kind of the town where I grew up. And I just so identified with her. So I was really, inspired by her. And she just, you know, she just was an advocate for underdogs and the underserved from the jump. And I thought it was miraculous. As a kid, she was going door to door and advocating for people and handing out flyers. And I love that. I just love, you know, that kind of perseverance and that kind of initiative. But I also have to say that when I started reading about people like Nellie Cashman and Nellie Bly and Madam C.J. Walker,
yeah.
and just people who at times when there was no one advocating for them, no one offering them a leg up, no one giving them, you know, the permission, they gave themselves permission.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really inspiring to me.
Yes. Definitely being involved with Bitchery and doing a lot of the research. The things that these women do were unfathomable now
yes.
and in the times that they lived in, even more so.
Right.
Like you said, women that just gave themselves permission. I was doing research today on Florence Nightingale, which is a sneak peek. We're doing Florence Nightingale.
Oh.
and she...
Spoiler alert.
That is exactly what she did. She just gave herself permission to rehaul the entire
medical
situation happening in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And she just gave herself the permission. She just did it.
And sometimes the women who did miraculous things did them because they didn't really have a choice. And they just said it was this or nothing. Like Annie Edson Taylor is the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel and live. She was 63 years old when she did this. And she did it because her family was starving. And she did it as a publicity stunt to make money.
Yeah.
So it's just, women are survivors, damn it.
Yes.
They are survivors. And
absolutely.
It's like, don't tell me I can't. I can.
Yeah.
Just show me the door. Let me, you know, I've got to figure it out.
Yeah.
And then they do.
Or if you aren't going to help me, then get out of my way.
That's right.
Because I'm going to do it anyway.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, I'm so excited. I want to watch this TV show now too.
Oh, where is it? So glad. Yeah. Well, keep your fingers crossed. Say a prayer, light a candle, send a balloon up, whatever you have to do.
Yeah.
I'm calling upon all forces.
Everyone send out like a smoke signal.
Yes.
Towards Hollywood.
Yes.
Make this show.
Make this show. We need the Lost Women. It's not just that it would be interesting. I think we literally need this show right now. We need to get on track with what women are capable of doing, what they've just to see what they've done in the past and what we have the advantages we have now. You know, we could change the world, literally change the world.
I 100% agree.
Yeah. So,
wonderful.
and we are in a place where we need some changing.
Yeah.
We need some changing.
All right. Well, I'm going to wrap up.
I hate that.
I know.
I love talking to you guys.
We can talk once we turn the mics off, too.
Don't tell anybody. Okay. It's a secret.
And we would love to have you on Bitch With Me, so then we can talk even further about current events and what's happening now. And
you betcha.
Yes.
I'd love that.
But before you go, what would you like to promote, or where can we find you? What do you want everyone to know?
Well, I've already kind of promoted it. The Bechdel Babes Writing Partners. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in a writer's group for women, check that out, bbwritingpartners.com. If you want to read more about me, I'm at lilymercerwriter.com. But if you want to see the show Lost Women of American History, I'm a big believer in words have power, and just talk about it. Talk yes. to people about it. Because ultimately, if you talk about it enough, that will rumble through. Those, you'll start making ripples in the community, and that will change things, and that will come back. I just believe in that. I know that sounds a little woo-woo, but no, hey, I spent enough time in Sedona. I earned it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted.
I just want to watch that show.
Oh my God. It looks so cool, and I am so excited to try and see what we can do together.
I am excited as well. This is going to be a blast.
Yes.
For our cause of the week this week, we are going to do NOW, the National Organization for Women. They are at now.org. Very easy to remember. In 1965, Polly had a phone call with Betty Friedan, who at the time was the most famous feminist in the country.
The feminine mystique.
That's right. So she told Betty that she believed it was time to organize an NAACP for women. So in June 1966, during a conference on women's rights, a dozen or so women met in Betty's hotel room and launched NOW, National Organization
yes.
for Women. The NOW Foundation focuses on a broad range of women's rights issues, including economic justice, pay equality, racial discrimination, women's health and body image, women with disabilities, reproductive rights and justice, family law, term paper help, marriage and family formation, rights of same-sex couples, representation of women in the media, and global feminist issues. You can find them at now.org.
They are an amazing organization.
Love it.
All right. Well, guess what? Only 4 more episodes of season 3.
If you can't get enough of The Bitchery of History, you can find us on Facebook. Just search The Bitchery of History.
You can also find us on Instagram at that same handle, The Bitchery of History.
Twitter switches it up a bit. Switches it up a bit. That's nice. Just search Bitchery Podcast.
And then you can also find us on our website, umpboh.com, where not only can you buy those stickers, you can also contact us on our listener submission page.
As always, we could not make this show happen without our incredible team. So thank you to Jeanette,
Kim,
Sydney,
and Jess.
And remember,
bitches get stuff done. Vote.